Life is a workout, and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're crushing morning miles or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King.
Everyone has a fave Wendy's frosty flavor. And when you're choosing from chocolate or vanilla, it's not that hard. But now there's all new frosty swirls and frosty fusions. So try picking your fave from Oreo brownie fusion, Pop-Tarts strawberry fusion, strawberry swirl, brownie batter swirl, caramel swirl, and caramel crunch fusion. Not so easy now, huh? For a fresh way to frosty, gotta be Wendy's. Open till midnight or later.
At participating U.S. Wendy's, hours may vary by location. Oreo is a trademark of Mondelez International Group. Pop-Tarts is a trademark of Kellogg North America Co., LLC, used with permission.
This is the Hidden Killers podcast with Tony Bruschi and continuing coverage of the case against Karen Reed.
It's one thing to claim innocence, but quite another when physical evidence seems to directly contradict that claim. Imagine you're driving along, minding your own business, and suddenly your car is tied to someone's death by something as tiny and invisible as a trace of DNA. That's exactly what happened this week when the DNA analyst Nicholas Bradford took the stand in the Karen Reed trial, calmly dropped a forensic bombshell, and turned the Karen Reed murder trial from a complicated legal puzzle into a laser-focused debate on microscopic details. We got a lot to talk about today of what occurred in the trial of Karen Reed on day number 18. There's a lot to cover here, from that DNA to the timeline to old LinkedIn profile. It's all there. Let me know in the comments what you think about all of this on YouTube or X, Twitter, wherever you may be following us. Be sure to press subscribe as well, whether it's the podcast platform or one of the video platforms or social platforms. Hit subscribe so you don't miss any of our coverage on this. And of course, we're always wanting to hear your opinion. Bradford works for Bode Technology, the kind of lab that sounds like something out of a high-budget Netflix series. Bode Technology. We're here when no one else is, and we're watching. Okay, that's not what it is. It's not like Resident Evil. It's all crisp white coats and sleek equipment, right? Where small biological samples speak louder than any witness ever could. He explained to the jury that when investigators examined Karen Reed's black Lexus SUV, they found something intriguing on a shattered fragment of the vehicle's taillight. It wasn't just glass or plastic shards they were looking at. It was DNA. Tiny molecules holding massive implications. According to Bradford, this wasn't just any random DNA. It matched John O'Keefe's, the victim, the Boston police officer Karen Reed allegedly struck with her car. Shocking, right? It was strong, compelling evidence. Bradford mentioned a DNA mixture involving at least three people, one definitely male, but most critically, he confirmed that the probability of the DNA belonging to O'Keefe was overwhelming. Picture it like this. Bradford had essentially fingerprinted O'Keefe's biology onto Karen's SUV. For prosecutors, it was a home run. The type of forensic evidence most cases dream about. But here's the thing with forensic evidence. It's rarely that straightforward. For every piece of DNA pointing directly at one scenario, there's room to question, poke holes, and raise doubt. And that's exactly what Karen Reed's defense team jumped on. Defense attorney Alan Jackson took to cross-examining Bradford with the determination of someone peeling back layers of an onion, each question sharper and more pointed than the last. He wasn't denying that DNA existed or belonged to John O'Keefe. Instead, Jackson was asking, who else did you test? And more importantly, who didn't you test? Turns out investigators hadn't taken DNA samples from several other potentially critical players: Brian Elbert, whose home O'Keefe was found outside of; Kevin Elbert, Brian's brother and a detective himself; Brian Higgins, an ATF agent with connections to Reed; and Ken Berkowitz, who at the time was the Canton police chief, none of which had been struck by a vehicle. So unless they're out there rubbing their heads against Karen's taillight, I don't know. Why would you? These aren't random names plucked out of thin air. These are individuals closely tied to the scene, to the case, and possibly, according to the defense, to the mystery of John O'Keefe's death. Because, yes, they all went out there and rubbed their heads against her taillight. Now, imagine you're a juror. You've just heard compelling testimony that links the victim directly to the accused vehicle. Sounds cut and dry, but suddenly you're hearing that investigators may have left significant stones unturned. It's a bit like detectives proudly showing you a finished puzzle only to have the defense reveal they never checked under the couch for missing pieces. Even though you finished the entire puzzle and there's no more pieces to put together, but did you find more of those missing pieces underneath the couch? Well, the puzzle's complete over here. There wouldn't be any more pieces. Maybe they're pieces to another puzzle. I mean, there's stuff that you can find under couches. I mean, if you just looked at it and didn't realize the puzzle was complete over here, you may go, I wonder if it's from that puzzle. But then you look at the puzzle and it's complete. You don't need other pieces. But there's more puzzle pieces under the couch. You're right, there may be. But it ain't from this puzzle. Could those untested DNA samples have belonged to someone else? Could the presence of another person's DNA have suggested a completely different story? I don't know what that story would be. We beat him up. Then we rubbed our heads against Karen's taillight that's broken. All in an effort to frame her, or I don't even know where the story would go because it doesn't make any sense. Nor does it seem to introduce reasonable doubt. It just seems to be a lot of words that they're hoping the jury will think is actually meaningful. Bradford acknowledged this under intense questioning. He calmly explained that while DNA from two state police officers, Trooper Michael Proctor and Yuri Bukenik, was tested for contamination and largely ruled out, he had not been asked to test samples from others who might reasonably have left traces. Bradford, the meticulous scientist, admitted he never explicitly excluded those possibilities because he wasn't asked to pursue them. Because it makes no sense! The defense launched into this omission, highlighting that absence of evidence is not necessarily evidence of absence. The defense also drew attention to Bradford's careful wording. When Bradford spoke of the trooper's DNA, he used terms like strong support for exclusion and acknowledged he could not visually exclude them initially. The defense zeroed in here, underscoring that exclusion in DNA forensics isn't absolute, it's statistical. It's probabilities and numbers, not black and white certainties. Alan Jackson skillfully did use Bradford's own careful phrasing against him, making sure jurors understood that forensic science isn't foolproof. It's just 99.99999999.012% foolproof, which, you know, basically means it's foolproof. Despite how convincing it might seem at first glance, this moment did matter deeply because DNA evidence isn't just about linking a person to a crime scene. It's about eliminating doubt by drawing attention to the fact that multiple critical figures in the investigation weren't tested because there'd be no reasonable reason to test them. The defense planted seeds of uncertainty. They didn't need jurors to outright reject the prosecution's DNA evidence. They simply needed jurors to wonder, to question, and to doubt whether the investigators had truly covered every angle, even the unreasonable ones. Why didn't they test just random people that live on the street? I guess they could be there too. Maybe. I don't know. Because reasonable doubt, after all, is the magic phrase every defense attorney hopes to leave echoing in jurors' minds. And in this case, my God, they're shooting for that. And so as Bradford left the witness stand, jurors faced a decision. On one side, there's powerful forensic evidence tying the victim directly to Karen Reed's vehicle, evidence that seems to shout guilt. On the other, there's a nagging concern by some about investigative thoroughness or just random nonsense. It's as if jurors were given a map that clearly marks the path from Reed's SUV straight to O'Keefe's tragic end. But suddenly the defense points to an entire different map and different territories never explored because they're not on the path. And their hope is that they're going to leave them wondering if crucial information could be hidden just beyond the map's edges. You never know what's on the other side. Well, yeah, because that's not the direction I'm going. I'm not even looking there because it's not remotely part of this case. It's a forensic tug of war. With each side pulling jurors' trust back and forth, the DNA is undeniable, tangible evidence. But can jurors fully trust its interpretation if crucial questions remain unanswered? Bradford's testimony, with all its scientific certainty and cautious limitations, left jurors precisely in this, you know, kind of uncomfortable, thoughtful middle ground. Or at least that's what the defense sure hopes they left them as. As jurors mulled this over, the trial pivoted to yet another form of evidence, equally compelling and contentious, the digital forensic timeline that might finally reveal exactly when Karen Reed's SUV allegedly struck John O'Keefe. Of course, not without a lot of fog introduced. Not fog that naturally occurs, but fog from a fog machine that they basically brought in and said, here, it's foggy. It's natural. It's the environment. It's hot and it's cold, and fog has naturally occurred in this courtroom. Never mind that it smells like the stuff from haunted houses, slightly sweet, and not quite like real smoke or fog. And with that, a new layer of complexity awaited, ready to be unraveled. As jurors grappled with the nuances of the DNA evidence, prosecutors shifted their attention to another crucial component, the digital timeline. If DNA was the fingerprint linking Karen Reed's vehicle to the victim, the digital evidence was the stopwatch ticking down to the precise moment of tragedy. And that's exactly where digital forensic expert Shannon Burgess stepped into the spotlight. Burgess, with the meticulous patience you'd expect from someone who spends their days decoding digital breadcrumbs, presented an analysis of data from Karen Reed's SUV. According to him, the Lexus had logged a backing up maneuver at an eerily specific moment, precisely when John O'Keefe's phone stopped recording activity. Burgess explained it simply. Every car today is essentially a rolling computer, tracking every little action from ignition to braking to reversing to when you pull that mirror down and the light comes on. And every smartphone, of course, is even more intrusive, logging each tap, step, or pause. Matching the data from those two devices, Burgess stated confidently, showed the SUV moving backwards at the exact instant O'Keefe's phone was manually locked, never to be unlocked again. This synchronization of vehicle and phone data wasn't trivial. It was potentially explosive evidence, and if accurate, it firmly placed Reed's car at the critical juncture, aligning perfectly with the prosecution's argument that Reed's vehicle fatally struck O'Keefe at the very moment. To illustrate this clearly, picture two separate clocks running on different devices, one in Karen's Lexus, another on John's phone. Burgess's job was essentially syncing these two clocks, adjusting them like a technician, revealing a synchronized narrative, a narrative that strongly favored the prosecution. But digital timelines are tricky. They require absolute precision, and even the smallest errors can ripple outward, turning solid evidence into questionable conjecture. But at the same point, think about this. The vehicle shows a strike, even if his timeline is slightly off. Where and why did that strike occur, considering you have a dead man and a broken taillight on the side of the road? One may put those together and go, this seems to connect the dots. But even more scientifically proven when the dots match up exactly. Burgess himself conceded this fact, noting slight discrepancies between the clocks. The SUV's internal system lagged about 20-some seconds behind real time when compared to O'Keefe's phone data. It was a minor correction in his view, but those seconds could mean everything in a trial where timelines matter immensely. Recognizing that, the defense didn't hesitate. Defense attorney Robert Alessi jumped immediately into an aggressive cross-examination. His approach was sharp and methodical, aimed at unraveling not just Burgess's data, but his very credibility. And Alessi quickly found his angle. It turned out Burgess had a glaring inconsistency in his professional history. Under oath, Burgess admitted that his official documents and online professional profiles incorrectly claimed he had completed a bachelor's degree, when in reality he hadn't. Burgess attempted to explain, called it a clerical mistake or oversight, but Alessi was having none of it. It must mean everything's a lie. Everything you say, we can't believe it. All the data is false because your LinkedIn profile hasn't been updated in years. Oh, wait, neither has yours. Or Garen's. Or most people. With each claim yet incisive of questions, Alessi amplified the notion that if Burgess couldn't accurately represent himself, jurors might reasonably question his accuracy interpreting complex digital evidence. Maybe he can't even get out of bed in the morning. How does he know to turn the key in his car? Or maybe you have to press a button or turn a dial. How does he know to eat? How could he possibly care for himself? He should probably be in a padded room because that LinkedIn profile is not accurate. The courtroom watched closely, recognizing that expert testimony hinges as much on trust as it does on technical details. After all, forensic data isn't self-explanatory. It demands interpretation, and interpretation relies heavily on experts' integrity. By undermining Burgess's reliability, Alessi sought to undermine the entire foundation of the prosecution's digital timeline evidence. But the defense wasn't finished. They turned their focus next to conflicts between Burgess's testimony and earlier reports presented by another digital analyst, Ian Whiffen. According to Whiffen's findings, O'Keefe's phone continued recording movement, specifically 36 steps, covering roughly 84 feet, several seconds after the alleged moment of impact defined by Burgess. This significance of the discrepancy cannot be overstated. If Whiffen's data was accurate, it could indicate that O'Keefe, or at least his phone, continued moving slightly after the supposed collision. This posed a serious contradiction when Alessi highlighted vividly for the jurors. His argument was clear. How could O'Keefe's phone be registering steps after the prosecution claimed he'd been fatally incapacitated? Burgess, on the defensive now, carefully explained that discrepancies could exist due to slight variations between device clocks, data synchronization errors, or even delayed registrations within the phone's pedometer. He maintained that the core timeline remained valid, but the damage, at least from the defense's perspective, was already done. The mere suggestion that Burgess selectively interpreted data to bolster the prosecution's case was exactly the seed of reasonable doubt Alessi hoped to plant firmly in the jury's mind. Did it, though? It wasn't just the defense, though, who understood the importance of these digital discrepancies. Judge Cannone had a crucial role, too. Faced with defense objections, she carefully considered whether Burgess's controversial testimony should even be allowed. Her decision was clear. Burgess could testify, but she granted the defense substantial leeway in their questioning, explicitly allowing them to probe Burgess's credibility in depth. It was a significant ruling. By permitting the jury to hear Burgess while simultaneously encouraging rigorous scrutiny, Judge Cannone shaped the courtroom's dynamics significantly, indirectly signaling to jurors that credibility mattered deeply. And it does. And I question the prosecution. Why is this your guy? Granted, it doesn't change the data. But could we find somebody who maybe didn't pad their resume? Maybe we should look into that a little bit before we put somebody on the stand. Maybe find somebody who really, there ain't nothing you're going to do to this guy in terms of his credibility. I mean, granted, the defense is doing their job without a doubt. So good for them for doing their job. But if you notice, they didn't question anything about the timeline. Because at the end of the day, who's ever really going through this data? It's data. Whether you said you got a bachelor degree on LinkedIn or not. For jurors, the decision was far more than a procedural footnote. It sent a message loud and clear that digital evidence, while compelling, wasn't immune from challenges, although there's really no challenge to the data. It was just more of his LinkedIn profile. Alessi's cross-examination underscored that reliability and expert testimony isn't automatic or guaranteed. It requires transparency, honesty, and precise consistency, qualities the defense argued Burgess lacked, given his credential inconsistencies. and the timing of his analysis. Adding fuel to this fire, the defense questioned why Burgess' detailed timeline report appeared late in the trial. They pointed out that he had earlier access to relevant phone data months before he completed his analysis. Why, they wondered openly, was this precise alignment introduced suddenly mid-trial rather than from the onset? Fair question. Alessi suggested, subtly but powerfully, that perhaps the prosecution was shifting gears, adjusting its case to new problems emerged, implying a reactive rather than proactive investigative process. In response, prosecutors maintained their stance that data and the delay wasn't tactical but simply procedural, a natural outcome of how forensic data is analyzed and validated. Sometimes it does take time. Yet the mere implication from the defense hanging over the courtroom could be enough to sway jurors toward skepticism. And again, that's the goal of the defense. That's, you want reasonable doubt. They're trying to plant the seeds. When Burgess finally stepped down from the stand, the courtroom had changed. Jurors who might have initially viewed digital data as clean, indisputable fact now had reason to maybe reconsider. Alessi had masterfully illuminated the shadows, areas of ambiguity, human error, and professional misrepresentation, showing jurors that forensic timelines, no matter how precise they appear, are still interpretations influenced by human judgment and potential error, without even talking about the timeline. He said nothing about the timeline. It was strictly all about how this man talked about a bachelor's degree from years ago. But reasonable doubt it is. That's why you got to be careful with what you put on the stand. You know that moment in a courtroom when everything just kind of seems to click, like the gears of the lock falling into place one after another until you hear that final, the door swings open? That was today in the trial of Karen Reed. In a trial that's had more twists than a corkscrew, today might have been the day things actually started to align. And not in a speculative what-if kind of way. We're talking data. Cold, unblinking, time-stamped data. Straight from Karen Reed's Lexus and John O'Keefe's phone. Two digital witnesses who don't forget, don't embellish, and don't take sides. Let me know what you think about the testimony today in the comment section if you're watching us on YouTube or Twitter, X, wherever it may be. Love to hear your thoughts. Be sure to press subscribe if you're listening on the podcast platforms, wherever it is, and do check out YouTube and vice versa. Press subscribe wherever you're at so you don't miss any of our coverage on this case and the many cases that we're covering for you right here at True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast. Okay, on with this story. The star of the day was a guy named Shannon Burgess, okay? Now, Burgess isn't a household name, but he's a digital forensic expert, the kind of guy who speaks fluent data and can pull breadcrumbs out of the tech most people never even realize is tracking them. And while we'll get to some colorful questions about his resume later, what mattered today was what he found, because what he uncovered may be the single most damning piece of evidence we've seen thus far. Burgess took the stand and held it out, laid it all out for everyone. Reed's Lexus SUV, the one she was driving that night, was shifted out of reverse between 12:32:04 and 12:32:12 a.m. in the morning on January 29th, 2022. Okay, so let that sink in. 8 seconds. Here's a kicker. John O'Keefe's iPhone? It was locked for the final time at 2:32:09 a.m. right in the middle of that window. His phone never moved again. For prosecutors, that overlap wasn't just a coincidence, it was the collision. According to them, this is the exact moment John O'Keefe was struck, allegedly by Karen Reed's SUV as she backed out of the driveway at 34 Fairview Road. The implication? That this wasn't just an unfortunate accident, but the moment of impact that ended his life. No guesswork, no circumstantial theory, just timestamps, data. The car said it, the phone said it, and later, well, so did Karen. Yes, because in another spectacular moment of this trial, Karen's mouth gets her again in interviews that she gave after the fact.
It's really quite stunning, but we'll get to that in a moment. The data Burgess used came from a micro SD card buried inside the Lexus's event data recorder. Think of it like a car's version of a black box. This isn't new tech, but it is often overlooked. In fact, it was overlooked in this very case until Burgess got involved. Previous analysts never retrieved it. Whether they didn't know where to look or didn't dig deep enough, the point is they missed it. Burgess didn't. That detail wasn't lost on the jury. Here was a new piece of evidence presented with the kind of surgical precision that prosecutors love, showing Reed's vehicle movement and O'Keefe's phone activity aligning with a 3-second window. That's not the kind of detail you can fake. These aren't witness statements. These are time-coded records burned into digital memory. You can't coach a Lexus to lie. Of course, the defense objected to this new analysis being introduced. They argued it was late. They argued it shifted the timeline. They argued it wasn't fair. But Judge Cannone let it in. And once it was in, it became the spine of the prosecution's narrative. This wasn't just about proving Karen Reed was near the scene. This was about when, down to the second. And that's where the audio comes in. In addition to the black box data, the jury heard 3 audio clips from Karen Reed herself. Interview recordings made not under duress, not under cross-examination, but during the early phase of the investigation when she was speaking freely. In one clip, Reed explains how she overshot the turn into Fairview Road that night. She says she had to pull a 3-point turn a little closer, a little after at 12:20 a.m. to get back on track. The prosecution used this to place her close to the scene, not long before the impact window. It's not a confession, but it definitely is proximity. Then came the 12:41 a.m. voicemail. Reed had called O'Keefe, and on this message, you can allegedly hear her SUV pulling into his driveway or garage. Now, here's where the prosecution leaned hard. If this voicemail really captured the sound of her arrival, then she was at the scene well after O'Keefe was already lying in the snow. That, they argue, makes this voicemail less about concern and more about trying to restage the scene. But maybe the most telling clip was the third one. In it, Reed plainly states that O'Keefe was believed to have died around 12:25 or 12:30 a.m. That statement by itself might seem harmless, but matched against the Lexus data and the iPhone timestamp, it's incredibly specific. In fact, it's almost too accurate, uncomfortably close to the actual window when the Lexus was in reverse and O'Keefe's phone went silent. Prosecutors didn't need to say much after that. They just let the alignment speak for itself. You've got the car shifting out of reverse at 12:32:04. You've got the phone locking at 12:32:09. You've got Reed herself estimating the time of death occurred around 12:25 or 12:30. And you got all of this tied up with a clean bow in the form of expert forensic testimony and machine-logged timestamps. Even for a jury that's been through nearly 3 weeks of dueling experts, alternate theories, and timeline disputes, this moment felt a little different. It felt sharp. It felt surgical. Hard to dismiss. Not theoretical. Not anecdotal. Just hardwired events all converging at the same time, in the same place. Because keep in mind, Karen saying, "We think he died around 2:25 or 2:30 in the morning." Okay? Well, that puts you there. And if it puts you, you know, just leaving or something, that doesn't give any time for this "they beat him up outside" story. And if, why would you know he died at that time? Why? The wonder that is Karen Reed. Just like, how do you know where he was in the snow? Why do you think he got hit by a plow if he got in the house? Little contradictions there. She had no comment outside of court later in the day when asked about it. A little flustered, too. When asked what she thought of Burgess's testimony, she said, "Incredible." I mean, uncredible is how she said it. A little flustered. Sure, you can argue about interpretations, you can debate intent, but what you can't do is make this kind of digital alignment go away. It is the kind of evidence that doesn't care about reputations, resumes, or reasonable doubt. It just is. And for a prosecution that spent much of the trial trying to keep jurors anchored in evidence and out of the drama, this was a major win. And what made it even more effective was that none of it relied on character. None of it relied on emotion. It was numbers, seconds, coordinates. It's the sort of evidence that doesn't blink under cross-examination because it can't. It also can't give you the finger either. There's more to talk about here, especially the defense's attempt to discredit Burgess himself, which, let's just say, didn't go quite the way they hoped. And that's a whole story in itself, and it deserves the next piece of our time to break that part of the case down. Because when a defense tries to tear down the expert instead of the evidence, and when that effort boomerangs, it's not just a misstep. It's a problem, especially when the data still stands, which is what we're about to get into right now. Shannon Burgess had just finished presenting some of the most technically precise, potentially case-defining forensic analysis we've seen so far. He tied Karen Reed's Lexus to the exact second John O'Keefe's iPhone stopped responding, suggesting a collision in that moment that was impossible to ignore. But when it was time for cross-examination, defense attorney Alan Jackson didn't go after the timestamps. He didn't challenge the microSD data. He didn't even try to argue with the forensic methods used. Nope, he went after Burgess's college degree, or more specifically, the fact that he didn't actually have one. It was a move that screamed distraction. Jackson pulled out old versions of Burgess's resume that listed a bachelor's degree in computer science from the University of Alabama at Birmingham. Problem was, Burgess doesn't have that degree. And when pressed, he admitted it under oath. No ducking, no dancing, just said flat out, "I do not have a bachelor's degree." You could feel that oxygen shift in the courtroom. This was the moment the defense had been saving like a grenade in their back pocket. And to be fair, it's not a great look. Burgess's resume, as it appeared in older court records, including one from a 2023 Texas case, listed that degree. Jackson used it like a crowbar, prying into credibility. If this guy was willing to fudge his education, the defense argued, why should anyone trust the rest of what he's saying? They threw around words like mendacity, painted him as dishonest, and implied that all his data was suspect because the man himself couldn't be trusted. And here's the thing about grenades. They're messy, and this one, it kind of blew back. Because when the prosecution in this case got their turn on the redirects, Assistant DA Hank Brennan didn't waste time. He reminded the court that whatever was or wasn't in an old resume, none of that document was used in this courtroom. The Commonwealth didn't bring Burgess in because of some line on his CV. They brought him in because of his work speaking for itself. Brennan pointed out that Burgess had already updated his resume by October of 24 to reflect that he was currently pursuing a degree. He emphasized that Burgess has testified in dozens of trials across multiple states, and never once has his lack of a degree invalidated his expertise. Because unlike in academia, forensic analysis isn't judged on diplomas. It's judged on results. And Burgess has results. He found evidence in this case that previous analysis missed entirely. He pulled data from a vehicle's internal system that no one else had accessed, using tools and techniques that aren't available to your average investigator. His timeline was built from raw machine data, not interpretation, and that data hasn't been contradicted, not by another expert, not by the defense, not by anyone. So while the defense kept trying to get the jury to look at the resume, the prosecution just pointed them back to the car, back to the black box, back to the hard numbers. And if you listen closely, it was pretty clear what Brennan was doing. He didn't just defend Burgess. He reminded everyone that the courtroom isn't a college admissions office. It's a place where facts matter more than formatting. The digital fingerprint Burgess uncovered still exists, whether or not he wrote a thesis in undergrad. Then just as the courtroom settled from that skirmish, the Commonwealth called their next witness, Christina Hanley, a forensic scientist from the Massachusetts State Police Crime Lab. Her appearance wasn't as dramatic, but it was important. She walked the jury through the evidence that she processed from the scene: broken plastic pieces, fragments of red taillight, glass shards, and even a clear drinking glass collected from the vicinity of 34 Fairview Road and from Karen Reed's SUV. This wasn't speculative. It was her testimony. Hanley explained how each item was received, cataloged, and preserved under proper chain of custody protocols. She described how these materials were visually analyzed and categorized for potential evidentiary release. Some of those fragments, prosecutors contend, connect the crime scene to Reed's vehicle, physically reinforcing the timeline that Burgess had already digitally established. The defense tried to poke those holes too, but their attempts fell flat. At one point, they seized on what Hanley called a misstatement about the date of death. She mentioned January 29th when the official date is actually January 30th. It was a throwaway line, the kind of verbal slip that happens in any long-form testimony. But the defense pounced on it, suggesting it was further evidence of carelessness or worse, systematic sloppiness or conspiracy. Problem was, it didn't sink. Didn't stick either. Hanley clarified the error immediately, and the prosecution moved forward without a pause. The jury, by that point, had already spent the day watching the defense try to sell doubt while the prosecution kept stacking verifiable evidence. It was around this time that Judge Beverly Cannone called for a sidebar with both legal teams. We don't know what was said. Those conversations are sealed, but it likely concerned the evidentiary logistics or scheduling, whatever it was. It ended with the judge adjourning court for the day. But by then, the message had already landed. The defense may have hoped for the collapse or hoped to collapse the Commonwealth's case by assassinating the character of one expert witness, but they underestimated two things. First, how well Burgess knew his material. And second, how little a resume matters when your data lines up perfectly with the timeline of a man's death. They didn't manage to break the case. If anything, they reminded the jury that when your best counterargument is a typo from Texas, maybe the real story isn't in the man, but in the evidence he brought with him. If you were sitting in the trial of Karen Reed today, May 21st of 2025, you probably wouldn't have guessed the day would open with a mystery that had nothing to do with Karen Reed or John O'Keefe. Well, I mean, it had to do with the trial, but the first thing Judge Cannone did wasn't call a witness or address the jury. It was to clear the courtroom. And just like that, everyone was out. Something was up with the jury. No one knew what, and instead of airing it publicly, Cannone brought each juror up to the sidebar, one by one, behind closed lips and furrowed brows, to get to the bottom of whatever had sparked concern. She wasn't taking any chances. What we do know is this: no juror admitted to breaking any rules. Nobody confessed to discussing the case, being approached, or peeking at headlines they weren't supposed to see. And yet Cannone felt the need to remind them forcefully not to talk about the case, not to each other, not to their spouses, not to their dogs. Her tone from the account inside made it clear this trial is not going off the rails on her watch. So after that quiet storm of closed door questions, court resumed. No damage done. At least not from the jurors. And then walked in Dr. Azik Wolf. Yes, Dr. Azik Wolf. We're going to talk about what he talked about in just a second. But first, if you're new here, be sure to press subscribe wherever it is you're watching us, whether it's YouTube, Twitter, X, wherever it may be, or listening to us on whatever podcast platform you have found us on. Hit subscribe. And be sure to check out our platforms back and forth, whether you want the podcast or on YouTube or social. It's all over there. Hitting Killers with Tony Bruschi. Just search it wherever you are looking. All right. Dr. Azik Wolf. Oh, and this too. Comments. Tell me what you think about how all this went today. I'm really looking forward to seeing that. So if you're thinking Dr. Wolf, it sounds like a character out of a medical drama, right? Today, he played the part to perfection. He wasn't originally scheduled for today, but the prosecution moved him up, calling him out of order. He's a neurosurgeon from Miami, not your everyday brain doc. This is a guy who lives inside skulls, and he came to court with a very clear, very clinical explanation of how John O'Keefe died, and more importantly, how he didn't. Would you like to learn about that, kids? According to Dr. Wolf, the injuries that killed Boston police officer John O'Keefe didn't come from a bat or a hammer or any kind of weapon at all. They came from the ground. He told the jury that O'Keefe's skull showed a specific kind of trauma, a linear fracture, not a depressed one. In layman's terms, here's the difference. A depressed fracture is what happens when something like your head or something hits your head, like a hammer or a bat. A linear fracture, the kind O'Keefe had, is more what happens when your head hits something else, like concrete. Wolf explained that to get the type of injury seen in this case, O'Keefe would have had to fall backwards, hit the back of his head hard, and suffer an internal cascade that ultimately killed him. Now, it's important to understand how specific that analysis is. Wolf wasn't just guessing based on bruises. He's walked the jury through the photos and the autopsy, and if you're squeamish like I am, you gotta kind of take a break because it's very detailed and kind of gory, showing the base of the skull, the contusions on the brain, and what's known as in neurosurgical circles as raccoon eyes. If you've ever heard of that, raccoon eyes are bruises around the eyes caused by internal bleeding from a skull base fracture. They're not the result of someone punching you in the face. They're a sign of something much deeper, much more severe happening inside of the head. And here's where it got especially important. Wolf testified that raccoon eyes don't show up right away. They take time, 1 to 3 hours after the injury. It's a big deal because it suggests that O'Keefe didn't die instantly. He was alive for some time after the head trauma. And that trauma happened hours before he was found. It throws a wrench into several assumptions about when and where he sustained the fatal injury. Wolf went further. He explained that O'Keefe likely lost consciousness quickly after the fall, but his body didn't shut down right away. He believes hypothermia could have played a role in prolonging O'Keefe's life, his core temperature dropping so low that it delayed the biological process that would have otherwise killed him faster. It's cold comfort, literally, but it adds a layer of complexity to the timeline. Meaning he might have had a chance. Should someone have called. Not great chances, but a chance. If he wasn't just lying there in the snow. The one thing to look at in this case is he was likely very unconscious. So he wasn't aware that he was unable to move lying in the snow. Remember, this is a murder trial. The prosecution's theory is that Karen Reed backed her SUV into O'Keefe, hit him with the vehicle, and left him in the snow to die. The defense obviously disputes that entirely, and what Dr. Wolf offered today was something in between, a scientifically grounded explanation for the injuries without pointing fingers. He didn't say Karen Reed did it. He didn't say someone else did. What he did say was that the cause of death, blunt force trauma from a fall, doesn't match what you'd expect from a beating. And that's where things got a little more spicy. On cross, defense attorney Robert Alessi came in with a scalpel of his own. He pressed Wolf, asking if he had any forensic pathology training, because after all, determining cause of death is usually the job of a pathologist, not a surgeon. Wolf did not flinch. He didn't blink. He stared right ahead and even kind of chuckled at him. I'm not a forensic pathologist. I'm a brain surgeon. Then added, as if he almost rehearsed it, I see more brains than a forensic pathologist. Woo! Mic drop! You could hear a pin drop in that courtroom. Alessi, though, wasn't done because he's never done. Just keep digging. Dig, dig, dig. Y'all been hanging around Karen Reed too much. He brought up a laceration found on O'Keefe's eyelid. Could that have been caused by the fall? Wolf said no. It didn't come from the internal injury. That eyelid cut had to come from something external, and that was as far as it went. The cross was short, sharp, didn't rattle the witness. If anything, Wolf came out stronger. So what we're left with is a moment in the trial where science walked in and complicated the narrative for the defense. No big dramatics, no emotional breakdowns, just a man with decades of medical experience saying, here's how this happened, and here's how it didn't. Whether that lands with the jury the way it did with the gallery, calm, confident, and precise, is another matter. But today's session didn't end with Wolf. After lunch, the court shifted gears into the fine-grained details of forensic debris. That's where the puzzle pieces come out of, glass, the plastic, and the question of how much of a shattered taillight can really tell us about the death in the snow. Well, Dr. Wolf stepped down from the witness stand, having offered his medically grounded account of how John O'Keefe likely died. The courtroom shifted from skull fractures and brain swelling to something far more smaller. These very fragments, these shards, these slivers of plastic and glass, the kind of evidence that doesn't shout, but it whispers. And those whispers came from forensic trace expert Christina Hanley. Hanley took to the stand as a scientist with the Massachusetts State Police Crime Lab. Her specialty isn't blood or DNA, it's debris, trace evidence, the microscopic world that clings to clothing, embeds in bumpers, and hides in the corners of crime scenes. She doesn't work with certainties so much as she works with consistencies. That might sound like a soft kind of science, but when handled carefully, trace evidence can paint a detailed picture, if not a very sharp one, at least a textured one. The prosecution brought her in to talk about what was found on John O'Keefe's clothes and what was found on Karen Reed's Lexus. Because if you believe the state's case, the story is that Reed backed into O'Keefe with her SUV, causing injuries that led to his death and leaving him to die in the snow. After that happened, you'd expect to find some trace of that impact on him, on the car, or ideally both. Hanley started with what was recovered from O'Keefe's clothing. She examined the items collected from the scene, and what she found were tiny plastic fragments, clear and red. Some were barely visible. One no larger than a grain of rice. These weren't chunks you could pick up and hold between your fingers. It was a splinter-level material, the kind you'd find if something brittle, like a taillight, in the cold, broke on impact and scattered underfoot. Her analysis showed that these fragments were chemically and visually consistent with the type of plastic used in the Lexus SUV taillight assemblies. Specifically, the same type of Lexus that Karen Reed drives. Oh, go figure that. But, and this is critical, Hanley made it clear that she could not say with certainty that the plastic came from Reed's car. It was indistinguishable, yes, but not unique. In other words, it matched, but it wasn't a fingerprint because it's on every Lexus out there. It could have come from Reed's Lexus or from another taillight from the same make and model. It just happened to be there at that moment in time, right? And missing a taillight. Or theoretically from another object made with the same composite plastic. That might sound like a very much splitting of the hairs, but in the courtroom, consistent with and from are worlds apart. Still, for the prosecution, the implication, it was powerful. If O'Keefe had red plastic on his clothes that matches the shattered Lexus taillight and Reed's Lexus had a broken taillight that night, you start to get the contour of their argument, that her SUV made contact with them. The defense, of course, has its own angle, because why not? Maybe the fragments got there some other way. Maybe they aren't from her car at all. That's where the limits of forensic trace evidence leave the room for interpretation. You know, microscopic pieces being implanted in the conspiracy, I guess, is what they're going. Hanley didn't stop at plastic. She also testified about shards of glass found near where O'Keefe's body was, in fact, discovered. Outside 34 Fairview Road in Canton, investigators collected 9 fragments of clear glass from the area. And when Hanley examined them, she found something interesting. 6 of the 9 shards actually fit together. not just in a general way. They clicked into place like a jigsaw puzzle. And what they formed was a partial reconstruction of a drinking glass, specifically a cocktail glass that was also recovered at the scene, broken near where O'Keefe had been lying. That detail matters because it supports the idea that the glass shattered in that spot, likely as part of whatever event led to O'Keefe being left outside. O'Keefe being, obviously, the man who lost his life. Hanley's reconstruction in its quiet precision helped anchor the physical context of the scene. There wasn't just broken glass at the location. There was broken glass that matched a specific object found at that very spot. No one had to guess where the glass had been, whether it had been planted or brought in from elsewhere. The fragments told their own story. They had always belonged to that broken cocktail glass. There's more, though. Hanley was asked about what was found on Reed's Lexus SUV, specifically her rear bumper. Several tiny fragments were collected during the examination of the vehicle. Two larger pieces were analyzed and turned out to be clear glass, but here's where the trail got a little muddy. Those two glass pieces did not match the broken cocktail glass found at the scene. They weren't part of the same object. What that means, well, not much conclusively, just that Reed's bumper had glass on it from some other source. Then there were the three additional glass particles found on the bumper. Hanley told the jury that these pieces were so small, so degraded, that she could have analyzed them further. They were, for all forensic purposes, useless. No conclusions could be drawn about their origin. They were marked, logged, and left as exactly that, inconclusive. Under cross-examination, the defense went straight for the soft spots in Hanley's testimony. Robert Alessi, representing Karen Reed, zeroed in on the limitations. Could she say the plastic came from Reed's car? No, only that it was consistent. Could she say the unmatched glass on the Lexus came from the same scene? No. And the three particles that couldn't be analyzed? Well, they were just fragments with no voice. Alessi's goal here isn't to discredit Hanley personally. She came across as measured, competent, and very deliberate. But he wanted the jury to see the difference between scientific suggestion and scientific certainty. And that's really what today boiled down to. How far you can go with consistency. Trace evidence, by nature, doesn't often hand you a smoking gun. It gives you smoke patterns. Residual trails, threads that may or may not tie together. The state's case isn't being built on one conclusive piece. It's more like a mosaic. Plastic here, glass there, blood evidence elsewhere, each witness laying a tile. Hanley tiles were small, but they were not insignificant. She was calm under questioning. She made no leaps, no overstatements. When she couldn't say something definitively, she said so. That may seem cautious, but in a trial like that, caution reads as credibility. The jury listened closely. They didn't need scientists. Hanley walked them through the logic step by step, never overselling the point, but making sure they understood what her work showed and what it didn't. What stuck more than anything was the contrast. Plastic that matched, but could it be confirmed? Glass that fit like a puzzle, but didn't connect across the board. It was a day of near certainties and forensic nudges. Whether that's enough to sway a jury or just enough to make them ask better questions remains to be seen. What did you think of everything today? Was it groundbreaking? Was it bombshell testimony? I would say from the, if I were to pick one, I would go with Dr. Wolf early in the day. But the afternoon was, pretty consistent too. Microscopic pieces, not usually super even visible to the naked. That doesn't just happen. Well, it was planted. That would be an interesting one. And I just don't buy it. Follow the science, they say. Well, there's some science. Tell me in the comments what you think about what went on today. And be sure to press subscribe wherever you are listening to this or watching this, be sure to check us out on YouTube if you really want to comment, or on Twitter at Tony B Pod. Search Hidden Killers with Tony Brewski on YouTube to find us there or wherever you get podcasts. My name is Tony Brewski. We will talk again real soon.
Want true crime coverage all day, every day? Press subscribe now to the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today and get the latest cases delivered right to your feed.